It's more than just words on a page, more than ink and paper. It's a universe waiting to be explored, to learn from, to laugh with, to see life through a different lens. Every story leaves its mark, and every reader leaves with a bookmark. Welcome to The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon, I'm Batya Bricker, and a warm welcome to Bookmark, 101.9 Chai FM's book show dedicated to books and the people who love them. Today's show is a little different. For the next hour, we are going to immerse ourselves in the colours, in the flavours, stories and traditions of one extraordinary country, and that is India. India is a place that seems to exist on several planes at once. It's ancient and modern. It's chaotic, but contemplative, deeply traditional and relentlessly innovative. It's a place of dazzling contrasts. Sacred cows will wander past gleaming technology campuses. Centuries-old spice markets operate in the shadow of skyscrapers, and moments of profound stillness exist along what is a sensory overload of color, sound, and movement. And of course, the literary tradition in India, both its writing and its reading culture, is as rich and vibrant as everything else in this country. The Indian Penguin paperback is famous for really transforming their publishing industry. They have a very vibrant publishing industry, and even though so many of their citizens do not have means, do not have resources, they are still readers, and their literacy rate is incredible. So you have sweeping family sagas from an author like Salman Rushdie and Arundhati Roy, and then you have many books set in India or written by Indians that place us in that bustling Delhi market or that place in Rajasthan or the tea plantation in Kerala. So today's show is a literary journey into the country, not just its culture and its language and its the taste and smells, but also the imprint that it has left on South Africa. Have you visited India? Do you have a favorite Indian spice? Or have you tasted an Indian dish that was unforgettable? I would love to hear about it. Let me know on the WhatsApp line 061-895-1019. For South Africans, India is not just a distant, exotic destination. Our histories have been intertwined for more than 160 years. And the arrival of Indian indentured labor in Natal in 1860 helped shape the social, cultural, and economic fabric of our country. We have a Mahatma Gandhi and his philosophy of nonviolent resistance. We have Indian culture that's woven in many facets of South African life, in our food, in our music, in our language, our politics, and our communities. So after the break, I'm going to be talking more about a book that explores that, and it's nonfiction, which so many of you love to read. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. This is Bookmark, 101.9 Chai FM's show dedicated to books and the people who love them. And today we are deep diving into India. The first book that I want to discuss is a nonfiction title. Many of you are great readers of nonfiction, and it's not my go-to, but wow, this book I picked up and was so glad I did because I learned so much. It's a book called Belonging. It's the history of Indian South Africans by Ashwin Desai and Ghulam Vahed. Across centuries and oceans, this book takes you on a sweeping narrative which shuttles between the corridors of the Colonial Office in London, the contested streets of Durban, and the growing sway of Delhi. At its core are the untold struggles of Indian South Africans, communities who, in the shadow of empire, fought to resist the ever-present threat of repatriation. The authors have drawn on fresh research, and it weaves together seismic events that we all know: the independence of India, the rise of the South African National Party, the ominous promise of mass expulsions. But it mixes it with the texture of everyday lives. Of course, the 1960s brings upheaval with the Group Areas Act, which rips communities from their roots. You see these pictures of Cato Manor and what happened there. But out of this turmoil, the new townships nurture a new generation of educated children and professionals who forge hope in unexpected places. And one of the reasons belonging, this history of Indian South Africans, is such a compelling read is that it's not simply a political history or an account of the dates and legislation. It's populated with vivid, deeply human stories that illuminate the larger sweep of history through individual lives. So some of the most memorable stories and themes include the first voyage across the Kalapani. The Kalapani was the black water, and for many of those who boarded the ships in 1860, carrying these indentured laborers from India to Natal, they had to cross the ocean, this black water. And that itself was a profound rupture. It meant leaving not just their family and their homeland and their, you know, what they knew, but for some, it was social status and caste identity and even the possibility of return. Many had little idea where they were going. The voyage represented both hope and loss, a chance to escape poverty, but also to leap into the unknown. So I want to read a little piece from here just to give you a sense of what that felt like and what the lived experience was of indentured Indians coming to South Africa. And it was, it's a story told by Ramdin Ujada, who told a government commission in the 1880s about crossing the Kalapani and how, what he had actually lost when he did that. He said, "I'm going back to India to see my father, brothers, and sisters. Here, I have eaten with different people and broken my caste. My friends in India, if they hear that, will not even eat with me. So I need to come back. When I go back, I will ask my mother to cook. But if she knows what I've done, she will tell me. She will cook, but she will make me eat outside. No fine could bring me back my caste, being a Brahmin. Just before coming, my last offering to the Ganges was that of the holy thread. I was not worthy to wear it any longer. When the coolies come here, they lose all caste. Even the Brahmins intermarry with the Chamars. What is to be done?" So it's those kind of stories that are so evocative and so human that you can't help but relate. Of course, he goes on to, or the authors go on to describe women who refuse to remain silent and really challenging that simplistic image that Indian women were passive participants. We meet Gandhi before he was the Gandhi. We meet the shopkeepers and hawkers and entrepreneurs who lots of similarities with the Jewish smos, where they would travel by foot, by bicycle or wagon into rural areas, trying to establish business. But the richest story of all is the idea of belonging, because the descendants of these people who arrived, practicing different religions, speaking dozens of languages, formed something new, a distinctly Indian South African identity. Not Indian, not simply South African, but something combined and unique. And so this book is about belonging. It's about how belonging is something we build generation by generation through stories, memory, food, faith, language, family, and community. A book that can make this idea come alive and really give you a sense from a fictional point of view of what it was like for these indentured Indians is a book called Children of Sugarcane. It's by Joanne Joseph, and it's fiction, but it's set against the backdrop of 19th century India and the British-owned sugarcane plantations of Natal. We meet Shanti, who is a bright teenager stifled by life in rural India and facing an arranged marriage. And she dreams that South Africa is this opportunity to start afresh. The colony of Natal is the place she can escape poverty and caste and the troubling fate of so many young girls in her village. But months later, after this harrowing sea voyage, she arrives in Natal to discover the profound hardship and slave labor that awaits her. This is Joanne Joseph reading a clip from her book, Children of Sugarcane.
Shanti rises in the dark, feeling it knit around her, crackling like dry wool. She shuffles out of the small house, not wanting to wake her dreaming daughter. Her heart begins to batter against her ribs, but she only presses forward more deliberately, slightly out of breath, placing one shriveled foot before the other until she crosses the threshold to feel the dew moisten her face. Thick, dark stains the skies over the Madras Presidency. The scent of jasmine floats, while birds invoke the morning light. These eyes moisten at the thought of how far her silences have driven her only child from her. How cruel I have become in my old age, she thinks. She is a small, stubborn blot on the night now, the scratch of sand between her ginger-gnarled toes. Day will soon bleach the horizon, and she will face the coming dawn, despite the fear she has carried for more than 30 summers. Dawn has always brought loss, and yet this sunrise feels restorative. The charred sky catches its new flame. She reaches for its warmth, its peace, whatever forgiveness it might offer. And as the first surge of daylight spills across the sky, Shanti stands beneath it with the eyes of a child, drinking it in. Port Natal is suddenly with her, the same gash of sky, the smell of cut cane at daybreak, the hands, the faces, the voices that have lived inside her for decades. Memory lives in light, she thinks. Benevolence and redemption too. Light illuminates all, even the darkened hollows. The sundial's mad circles have slowed, and the time for concealment has run out. Secrets are wild birds. They cannot be held captive forever.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and today's book show is a little different. We have immersed ourselves in the colors, the flavors, the stories and traditions of an extraordinary country called India. Have you read a book on India? Do you have a favorite spice or a favorite food, an Indian food? I'd love to hear on the WhatsApp line 061-895-1019. We'll now turn to an author called Alka Joshi, who is the author of the Jaipur Trilogy, which was a best-selling historical fiction series by Alka Joshi. It started with The Henna Artist, then went on to The Secret Keeper of Jaipur, and then The Perfumist of Paris. For now, though, we're going to be talking about her newest book, 6 Days in Bombay. Good afternoon. Welcome back. My name is Batya Bricker, and you are listening to Chai FM's Bookmark, the home for stories and the people who love them. I'm currently at the Franschhoek Literary Festival. I'm rubbing shoulders with the literati of South Africa and beyond. And one of the greatest joys of a festival like this is not only being part of the audience for so many stimulating and entertaining sessions and conversations, but it's the chance to have a one-on-one, a little DMC, deep, meaningful conversation with internationally best-selling authors like Alka Joshi. Alka, a very warm welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Alka is the internationally best-selling author of the Jaipur Trilogy. You'll know The Henna Artist, and that was followed by The Secret Keeper of Jaipur and then The Perfumist of Paris. Her latest book is called 6 Days in Bombay, and it's what we in the trade call a standalone novel. In other words, you don't have to have read any other Alka Joshi books to know what's going on with this one. But as Alka points out in one of her previous interviews, the Jaipur trilogy also started as a standalone novel and it grew into a trilogy. So perhaps this is the start?
Well, we don't know yet.
We don't know yet. Let's see what it does. In 6 Days in Bombay, Alka Joshi uses as inspiration the life of a real-life painter called Amrita Sher Gill,
You may not have heard of her. I had not. But she is considered the Frida Kahlo of India. Elka, tell us a little bit about Amrita and what drew you to her story.
In 2019, I was in New Delhi, and I went to the Modern Art Gallery there. And there I saw paintings by a woman named Amrita Sher Gill. And the paintings really spoke to me because they featured a lot of women doing the things that women do in everyday life. And they had somber expressions in a way that sort of communicated that they had no agency over their lives. And I thought, oh, this woman is trying to communicate something through these paintings. I like them also because they were a mixture of impressionism, post-impressionism, avant-garde work. And I thought, wow, now I have a BA in art history and I've never heard of this woman before. Why is that? So I decided that I was going to do more research on her. And what drew me even further into her character was the fact that she was an iconoclast in the 1930s. She was highly independent, very much wanted to paint whatever she wanted to paint versus what women painters were supposed to paint. So, for example, she drew nudes at a time when it wasn't okay.
Elka goes on to talk about Amrita Sher Gill, her dual identity, and we talk more about that later, as well as her journey, her own journey of coming to terms with being both Indian and American.
My brothers and I just really felt that we needed to fit in an environment where we were the only brown kids. So I think that for years I fought the idea that I was even Indian at all. And then when I started to go with my mother to India again after a 40-year hiatus, I realized that India had so much culture, so much richness of heritage, and such a complex history that I didn't know anything about, and I needed to reacquaint myself with it, that I really fell in love with the country all over again. And I think, you know, one thing that I realize is that we all deserve to be proud of our heritage. And now that I am proud of mine, I want to write about it. And I want to write about it in a way that tells the many stories of India, not just the single story that I think people understood when I first came to the West.
Well, I think that your journey has been one of coming to terms with dual identity. And many of the characters in 6 Days in Bombay deal with dual character. Can you talk about that?
Yes. One of the things I found out is that in 1937, which is the setting of 6 Days in Bombay, the artist Meera comes into this very private hospital where people are paid more to work there, and it is basically run by British nuns and English doctors, that Anglo-Indians also are afforded the opportunity to work here. And so the nurse taking care of Meera, the painter, is Anglo-Indian. And when I found that out, I thought, well, this is interesting. Now I've got two main characters who have dual identity. They are both half European and half Indian. And what was lovely about that is that I've got one character, the painter, much the same as Amrita, who is very comfortable with both of her identities. And yet, the nurse is not comfortable with both of her identities because her English father abandoned her and her mother when Sona was only 3 years old. And so she looks up at Meera thinking, well, why is it that one person can be so comfortable with dual identity and another person can't? And I think that kind of relates to how I felt as a kid when I saw people with dual identities and they were very comfortable code switching or even maintaining both identities simultaneously. I wondered, how does that happen? And, you know, now I think I'm very comfortable accepting both of my identities, but it has taken me 6 decades to get here.
Yeah, it's taken me 5. So, and it's an ongoing process.
You know,
I think you get encountered, especially as politics change, as trends change, things become more fashionable, less fashionable. It becomes more difficult to be one thing and not the other. You know, so I think it's a work in progress. But I did want to, for the listeners, give you a sense of how evocative Bombay is in this book. It made me want to pack my bags and go and visit. I haven't been to India. And that is the culture and the backdrop of the story. And I found this description just both so entertaining and completely relatable. So the nurse who has now caught the eye of a young doctor called Amit goes on a kind of date, and they are heading back to her home, and she needs to, she's being escorted home. It's that awkward moment. And I wanted to read this. It says, "The carriage couldn't make it down our narrow street. So Amit walked me to our front door. He guided me with a hand at my elbow. I wanted so much for him to put his arm around my waist, to slide his hand under my wrap so I could feel his warm palm against my naked back." She was wearing quite a daring dress, by the way. "But it was 11 in the evening, and any scandal, even public displays of affection amongst married couples, was entertainment for prying eyes. We lived in India. Not Prague or Paris or Florence or any of the other places where Mira had lived and loved so freely. Where could Amit and I go, assuming we wanted to? Not to my flat, where my mother was waiting for me, not to Amit's apartment, where word of the indiscretion would travel faster than a monkey can scale a banyan tree. The man who shined shoes at the corner of Amit's apartment building would tell the peanut vendor on the next corner, who would tell his cousin, the mechanic, who would tell his wife, the one who cleaned the house of the society matron. And before you knew it, all of Bombay would know that Dr. Mishra had had a female visitor, or was she a harlot late at night? And did you see the half-naked gown she was wearing?" LK, it reminded me of living, as I do, in a small, tight-knit, enmeshed Jewish community. We have a saying that says, there are no secrets in Glen Hazel. Everyone knows your... So it's really, I think, indicative of beautiful, connected communities where people care about each other. But then you are living in each other's pockets, and there truly are no secrets. It's marvelous.
I love the way you read that. Do you know, sometimes when people read my work out loud, I think, I wrote that? You know, it comes as a surprise to me that I even wrote that. I think I have to pinch myself all the time thinking, I'm an author now? Like, I am here in Franschhoek in South Africa, all the way from California, and I'm going to be talking to South African readers about my books. It is an incredible journey that I have been on, an incredible time in my life that I even get to write about India and let the world know all of the many sort of little cultural and societal expectations there are.
It's rather marvelous, but it is also a responsibility. Do you feel a sense of responsibility to portray your culture and your people, as it were, in a certain way?
Yes, I do. I feel a tremendous responsibility to make sure that people understand the positive sides of India, the positives of the many different cultures that live there, the many different religions, the many different languages that are spoken, because I feel that the Western world hears a lot about the negative parts of India, but not enough about the positive parts of India. And indeed, I think India seems to export so much of their brain power across the world in medicine, in science, and math, and engineering. And that doesn't get talked about enough. And neither does the fact that India has so much richness of culture and design and textiles and jewelry in, home design, furnishings, that kind of thing, that doesn't get talked about enough. And also the warmth of the people doesn't get talked about enough. So those are the kinds of things that I really feel I need to convey to people so that they get more than that single story they may have of India.
I think India is in the same situation as South Africa, in fact, and Israel, for different reasons, where you are the country and the people are reduced to headlines.
Yeah.
And there is so much more. There is so much more humanity. There is so much more richness. There is abundance. There is so much to celebrate that it doesn't sell newspapers. But actually it's the stuff that feeds the soul.
Exactly. That's so well said. Yeah.
The Jewish connection in this book is quite surprising.
It was surprising to me too.
I think it was a surprise for you too. And how did you come across it? And was it in your research that you stumbled upon some interesting facts?
Well, first of all, I find out about Amrita that she is Hungarian Jewish on her mother's side.
Oh, okay.
And that she was Indian on her father's side. And that the family in the interwar period between World War I and II were constantly coming down to India and hanging out with either his family or the many houses that his family had around the country. And I talked to my dad. I said, "Dad, were there Jewish people in India in the 1930s? He goes, "Oh, honey, Jewish people have been coming to India for hundreds of years to escape persecution in other lands, because India is the only place that has never persecuted against the Jews." And so Jewish people came here first in the 1600s from Baghdad. They were the Baghdadi Jews. They settled in Mumbai, and there are still 8 synagogues left in Mumbai that can be visited. And then came the Cochin Jews and then the B'nai Israels. And so in the southern part of India are all of these vestiges of Jewish communities. There are still kosher bakeries where people line up around the block to eat the fabulous treats. There are signs everywhere in both Hebrew and in the native language. Men would proudly wear kippahs on their heads during this period in the Jewish communities and display Stars of David across their front gates. And nobody had to worry about it. They never were fearful that Indians would persecute them in any way. So I thought, well, this is really interesting. I delved further into the Indian Jewish history and found out that in Bollywood, our earliest female and male starlets, stars were Indo-Jewish people, because Hindu and Muslim women were not allowed to be on stage in public. And so it was the Indo-Jewish women with their tradition of entertainment and singing and dancing who said, "Well, I'll be a star." And so we had women like Ruby Myers, whom I found a way to work into 6 days in Bombay. And she's cutting the ribbon on Mira's father's synagogue that he is helping build. And then, of course, there was Esther Abraham, who performed as Pramila.
Yes.
And not only was she an actress, but she also had her own studio and she made films. She was a producer. And then we had David Abraham, who performed as Uncle David. So there were so many of these wonderful actors that were really featured in all of these early Bollywood films. And also 6 of the 8 movie houses were run by Jewish men who would then learn what was happening in Hollywood. They would go to California, they would come back, and then practice those same techniques in Bollywood. So I just thought that was so fascinating. Bollywood owes a lot to the Indo-Jewish community.
It's the most fascinating thing. I did a research. I did during COVID. My project was, I wrote a book called Goodnight Golda, and it was a tribute to 33 women who have made enormous contribution to the world, Jewish women, and changed our world forever. And one of them was Victoria Abraham, Pramila, who was the first Bollywood star, and she was a Jewish woman. It's so unexpected. So unexpected and just interesting to see how it really was a quirk of cultural fate that Jews landed up in Bollywood. But as you say, they made it happen in many ways.
And Indian audiences were crazy about them.
It's fascinating. Aside from the mountains of research that I know you did for this book, you now speak about certain ingredients. They're very particular key elements that make up a good novel. What are those elements?
I think one of the things that, especially for historical fiction, that one I can speak to because that's what I write, is it has to have some careful research behind it in order to authenticate what is happening in a certain time period. And it's so important that readers feel as if they are walking in the footsteps of the protagonist. So this is why, particularly for me, it's important that I go to the settings I'm going to write about and that I meet with experts in those settings who are going to take me around to all the places that my protagonist is going to go. They suggest places. I also have places already outlined that I want them to show me. And we go through all of that detail. And I get so many great ideas and anecdotes from them that make their way into my books. A third thing that I think is necessary is that we have to have character development, which means that the characters have to somehow change throughout the novel. And this is important for every main character. You can't just have a flat character for whom nothing changes. Otherwise, there would be no reason for the novel. But they're going through some kind of a journey that is going to change them forever. And of course, this is what happens to Sona during this journey throughout 1937 Europe as she is delivering four paintings that she has inherited from Mira after Mira's death. And so it became really fun for me to develop these characters like Sona, like Dr. Stoddard, like Amit, like, Indra, and then to see whether they would change and in what ways they would change. That to me is really interesting because I am a plotter. I'm not, I'm a pantser, not a plotter.
Okay.
And so what it means is that I never know where things are going until I get there.
So the story tells you where it needs to go.
Absolutely. The characters tell me. And sometimes if I'm stuck, I actually ask the character where they want to go next. And it's surprising that if you have developed your characters to the point where they can actually answer you, that is an amazing thing because they're actually helping you write the story.
6 Days in Bombay is riveting, it's resonant, it's richly detailed, it's an absolute must read. You will know Kristen Harmel, and she talks about this book. She says it's a compelling and richly textured tale of art, of loss, and identity. It's available in all good bookstores. Alka, a very, very warm thank you for joining us. It's been a delight.
Thank you, Batya.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricka.
Today we've spent time immersed in India, its culture, its food, its flavors, its sounds. And one of the best ways to explore a country's richness is through its food. I know for me, and I've spoken about this book before, Karima Isaac's book, Curried, has taught me, a nice Jewish girl, to make a killer curry. And my thanks and my family's thanks go to Karima. But the hottest new kid on the block in Indian food is Fems. The book is called Damn Good Food, and you can't miss it because it is bright, bulshy, on the shelves. It's Damn Good Food really describes her cooking style, her way of talking about cooking. It's no mess, no fuss, just damn good food. Her real name is Femida Jordan. And she's a major figure in South Africa's culinary and digital space. She's been recognized for her engaging personality. She has over 300 followers on Instagram. But now she has exploded onto the cookbook scene with her release of her book, Damn Good Food. And it became an instant bestseller in South Africa. It offers not only her family's tried and tested classics, but also fun twists like chili bite waffles or karak ice cream or kataifi milfil. Just by the way, this kataifi, or I should say kataifi is how you say it in Greek. Kataif is how you say it in Arabic. And it's that shredded pastry, that shredded pastry that you make, that you use to make baklava and other amazing treats. Just by the way, the Mediterranean one is kosher, so it's time to try that. But she uses that. She talks about sticky jam chops, lemon chicken, flavor bombs, family treasures, and what she calls fakeaways, so restaurant style eats that you can prepare at home. It's no fuss, no pretense. It's bold. It's unapologetic. Take a look at that on the shelves. And then I wanted to talk about The Village Indian. It's a book by Vanessa Govender, who you may remember because she was an award-winning former television and radio news journalist. She, a couple of years back, wrote a book called a best-selling memoir. It was called Beaten But Not Broken. And she did the unthinkable. She broke the ranks of a close-knit conservative community to speak out about a five-year-long hell, really, in an abusive relationship with her co-presenter, who at the time was the darling of Lotus FM. So her previous book really rattled some cages, and in the aftermath of this expose, it prompted a journey to move to a small village, leaving Durban. Both her husband and herself had families in Durban, and Durban just became too small for the enormity of what had happened to her and what she had exposed. So it prompted the move, and they moved to the small village in the Western Cape. She never tells you what it is, but she really does live there. And she says she's not the only Indian. Apparently there are one or two more, but she has yet to meet them. And the result is The Village Indian. It's an absolutely delightful caper to a small village in the Western Cape, brimming with colorful characters and quirky happenings. It's one over-the-top, bolshy, city-slicker Indian woman, that's Vanessa, one reticent and reserved white husband, and their three children. And you find them in this far-flung village in the South African countryside where mixed-race families are really a rarity, and you get front-row seats to a lifestyle that is both delightful and discombobulating. It's told with generous dollops of quirky and sometimes perplexing Indian lingo that's unique to South Africans of Indian descent. And it's garnished with hilarity and introspection. And it's also an authentic celebration of identity and culture and food, not forgetting the confusion and chaos that often goes with being a South African. So you have run-ins from deadly snakes, everyday encounters with chickens, sprinklings of small-town scams and skullduggery. It's really enormous fun. And in this far, far away village, Vanessa says, I went not expecting much, but in the end, even though they look nothing like me, I found my tribe.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
I hope you have enjoyed this Indian Odyssey, our celebration of Indian writing, reading, and culture. We first looked at Belonging, which was a story. It's the story of South African Indians by Ashwin Desai and Ghulam Vahed, and gives you such a brilliant overview and sense of what it was like for Indians coming to this country and where Indian culture in South Africa really has its roots. We spoke about Children of Sugarcane, Joanne Joseph's novel, and then spoke to Elka Joshi about 6 Days in Bombay. We got a taste of Femme's Damn Good Food, and then ended with The Village Indian by Vanessa Govender. So that was the show for today. For next week, we are going to be exploring what happens when writers revisit stories that we think we know. So next week's show is all about the books that reinterpret history, mythology, and historical events through a 21st century lens. There are novels, there are memoirs. We are looking at overlooked voices, hidden perspectives, untold stories. which prove that the past is actually far richer and more complicated and more surprising than we imagine. These are stories that we thought we knew, and sometimes this new perspective gives a whole different angle and offers a completely fresh and different story. This coming week is on Tuesday, is the 16th of June, and it's been 50 years since 1976 Soweto riots. There are a number of books that have been published that relook the events that we think we know about through a different lens and give a fresh perspective. So I'll be talking about those. My interviewee is the award-winning Deepa Anapara, who is the author of a book called The Last of Earth. It's a stunning novel set in Tibet. And it was named as one of the BBC's 12 books to read in 2026. She said something so profound that made me really want to talk to her. And I think our conversation reflects that. She says, "My people are not in the archive." And what this book does, it is that it gives voice to the story of Tibet and the exploration of Tibet, but not just through the official white colonial record that we have in the archives, but through the multitude of rich and diverse characters and their view of the events. It's going to be a goodie of a show, so I hope to see you next week. For those running on Sunday, be strong and of good courage. You have my absolute respect and awe. For the rest of us, goodbye for now and happy reading.